Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic this hour is the struggle for transgender rights. Both last night and this evening, the E! Television Network is airing a special two-part Keeping Up with the Kardashians that shows former Olympian Bruce Jenner telling his family he's transitioning to being a woman. This comes a few weeks after he appeared in an interview with Diane Sawyer on ABC's 2020, where he openly discussed his transition. Meanwhile, the TV show Transparent, a fictionalized account of a divorced dad's transition, won 3 Golden Globe Awards this year and much critical acclaim. And for the past few weeks, the New York Times has been running a series called Transgender Today. From Chaz Bono to Chelsea Manning to Laverne Cox from Orange is the New Black, the list of transgender men and women in the public eye is growing. However, despite all this publicity, there are still challenges for the transgender community, some of them quite grave. Rates of depression, suicide, and HRV are much higher than in the general population. Now that the media is hyping a so-called transgender tipping point, will increased awareness lead to increased acceptance, improved access to quality health care, and legal protections? What is needed to help elevate the status of transgender men and women? And is this the next big civil rights issue? Joining me in the studio tonight and by phone to discuss these issues and more are Dr. Maddie Deutsch. She is Director of Clinical Services at UCSF's Center of Excellence for Transgender Health. Welcome, Maddie.
Hello. Great to be here.
We're also joined in the studio by Jameson Green. He is president of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, also known as WPATH, and author of Becoming a Visible Man. Welcome, Jameson.
Thanks, Joseph.
And we're also joined in the studio by Dr. Barry Zevin. He is clinical lead with Transgender Health Services at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Welcome, Barry.
Thank you for inviting me.
And by phone, we are joined by Anand Kalra, and he is Program Administrator at the Transgender Law Center. Welcome, Anand.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And we invite you, our listeners, as always, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. That's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@KALW or post a comment at the KALW website. You can also tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Jameson Green, I wanted to start with you. Are we truly at a tipping point when it comes to the transgender rights movement?
Well, in a sense, yes, but I think we have a lot more tipping to go. Having media attention always puts things in another step up, basically. Without any media attention from the 1970s, when California changed its law to allow birth certificates to be changed after having surgery for sex reassignment, all through the 90s when protective ordinances were spreading across the country, there was virtually no publicity about this. So when Time magazine did their Tipping Point article last year, someone said on their website, I think, that now that we have transgender celebrities, we're going to see changes in the law. And I venture to say that we would not have transgender celebrities had it not been for the changes in the law that we've been doing for the last 40 years.
Quietly, it seems.
Yes, not that we've wanted to do it quietly, but nobody has cared.
So why now?
Well, I think there is a sort of shift going on, and you can see it in the parents of transgender youth, that now we see parents who are able to hear their transgender children and realize that they need to take some action to help them rather than tell them to just behave.
And how are parents, in turn, becoming more able to hear this and support their children?
I have no idea how they can do that. I mean, I am a parent also. I have a daughter age 30 and a son 26. And, you know, my perspective on parenting is that you allow them to be who they are. And maybe that's a generational thing that my parents didn't quite have that. I don't know. They tried, but they had their struggles to deal with that were well, their prejudices. They had their prejudices that they couldn't let go of. And I think, you know, as a society, we have learned a lot more about diversity and sexuality than, and a lot of transgender stuff gets mixed up with sex, and it's not always that way. It's not always connected to sex that someone transitions.
So let me open that question to the other guests as well. Maddie Deutsch, what do you think? Are we at a tipping point, and why now?
You know, I think we are at a tipping point. I think that it's been progressing in an exponential fashion, and we crossed some kind of threshold. I think that in the last few years, there have been a couple of high-profile transitions. There was Laverne Cox, and before that was Chaz Bono. And, you know, as these people transition publicly, each one kind of builds on the prior. So I think, like Jameson was saying, that the initial existence of some laws that kind of codified the fact that transgender people exist allowed these highly visible people to go through their transition. And if you look at Chaz Bono to Laverne Cox to Bruce Jenner, I feel like it's been easier a little bit from a kind of public eye perspective. It seems like people kind of get it a little bit more. You know, with Chaz Bono, it was like, oh my God, they're transgender. And with Bruce Jenner, it was like, can you believe that Bruce Jenner is transgender? So the excitement was less around trans and more just around Bruce Jenner. And I think that as we see more and more of these high-profile people, it kind of takes away some of the ooh and ah around it and kind of normalizes a little bit. And a friend of mine who lives in Orange County was getting her hair cut, and she said the people who sit on both sides of her at the hairdresser, who were sitting there, kind of conservative, middle America, Orange County people, were just talking about how moved they were by the Bruce Jenner interview and how they can understand how difficult it is to be in a body that you don't identify with.
Hmm. Barry Zevin from SFTPH.
Well, I have to say that the tipping point to me in the work I do with poor people in the Department of Public Health is absolutely due to the work of transgender advocates and activists in the community. This is about years. I've been involved in this kind of work for over 20 years, and this is about years of people like Jameson and other people saying, this population cannot be forgotten. It cannot be invisible. It cannot continue to have all of the brunt of discrimination and violence and need services. And all the progress we've made, it has been about advocates working in terms of self-determination, working in terms of the community voice saying, we are going to have to move ourselves up into visibility, as painful as that can be, to prove that we are as worthy of human respect and dignity as anybody else. And that's where I see the tipping point is years and year after year of that tide has resulted in people like the member of the board of the Health Commission, Cece Chung, being able to be present on the Health Commission and saying, yeah, this is an important issue for me, along with all the other important health issues.
Hmm. And Anand Kalra from the Transgender Law Center, what's your take on this question and specifically the timing of why now?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's a great question to ask. And I would say we're not so much at a tipping point as a takeoff point. If you look at what's happened with other social movements where you know groups have organized together to overcome injustices, you have to look at three different things. One is the public awareness of the problem. The other is public opposition to the problem, and then public support for the problem. And where we are right now, there's a huge upswing in public awareness, but public support isn't necessarily matching that same pace. And of course, the more visibility we have, the more visible we are to our opponents and to those who would try to push us back in terms of progress and kind of roll back the gains that we have had. Why now? I think we've seen a lot more diversity in the public, in the public imagination, in mass media, in politics, around people with different ways of expressing themselves, whether that's through their gender or through their sexual orientation. And it's kind of helped set a foundation for transgender people to fit in people's minds. You know, if people, you know, transgender people have been around for a long, long, long time, and yet, you know, we haven't quite clicked into people's minds that we exist, and it's, I think, a lot due to the fact that people didn't have a place to put us. And now that there's a lot more open conversation around gender and around sexuality, I think people have, you know, they have a schema in which we can fit.
So how does this track, and this, again, I'll open it up to all of you, but I'm going to stay with you, Anand, for a moment. How does this track with the gay rights movement? You know, there's lots of interesting history there. That in fact, there was a pre Stonewall. There was the Compton riots here in San Francisco when a group of transgender women were kicked out of a cafe in the Tenderloin. But that doesn't get talked about nearly as much as Stonewall. So how is there a synergy? How much is the transgender movement riding a bit of the wave, and how much is it trying to distinguish itself from the gay rights movement at this point?
That's an interesting question, and I'm glad you brought up the Compton riots, because, as you said, they did, you know, they predated Stonewall, the riots in New York, of course, that are commonly thought of as the kind of launching point of what we think of as the LGBT rights movement. But there's actually been a lot of different points in history, even just in the last 100, 150 years, here in the U.S. even, just, you know, to be narrow about it, that look like people with different gender expressions, different sexual orientations, organizing around ways that they've been discriminated against specifically. And even at Stonewall, you know, some of the folks who started fighting back against the police brutality were transgender people and gender nonconforming people. And in particular, transgender women of color have been really at the forefront of the fight for basic dignity, for human rights, and yet kind of get forgotten about or pushed aside deliberately by folks who have more power in the community and are you know, trying to make their own way towards equality versus liberation for everyone. So the question of, you know, is the transgender movement completely separate, or is it riding the tails? I think it's a little bit of a tricky question there, because one, you know, transgender people of course also have sexual orientations, and so there are of course lesbian and gay and bisexual and queer transgender people, and so in that way we, you know, fit in directly with other movements around sexual orientation and rights in that direction, as well as, you know, there's this way that we think about, you know, if you want to take the example of workplace non-discrimination, and if you think about people being discriminated against for being gay or for being lesbian, a lot of times what people are actually, you know, getting harassed about is the way they present their gender. And so, you know, if a man is being perceived as being, quote, too feminine, or a woman is being perceived as too masculine, you know, with those in quotes, of course, that's really about gender. And so the way that gender nonconforming and transgender people fit in is that, well, we've always been there, and we've always kind of been at the center of it, and yet being pushed to the sides.
Jameson Green, do you want to add to that?
Sure. There's always been a lot of synergy between gay and lesbian and trans people in communities, but they're small communities. Trans people are spread out much thinner than gay and lesbian people, and they don't really tend to congregate in major cities other than in poverty. Basically, I think there's no transgender business district, for example. You know, there's no transgender bars. Well, there are transgender bars, but they're only that part-time. You know, they're not full-time transgender bars. They aren't 24/7. But there's, you know, just this the only place that transgender people could go historically, and particularly prior to being able to have surgical sex reassignment, before that medical technology came in. And that's not to say that all transgender people change their sex. They do not, and they should not. They should be able to express themselves the way they want to express themselves. But What I'm trying to get at is that this the gay communities were the only place that trans people, when they were forced out of their home environments, were able to find some kind of connection. People like them, men who seemed feminine, some men who seemed feminine, some women who seemed masculine, and they would be accepted in those environments. But all trans people don't go there. There are thousands of transgender people living in isolation or integrated into straight communities who have no connection whatsoever to the LGB communities at all. And many of them absolutely don't want it.
See themselves as separate from
absolutely,
that.
Completely.
Barry Zevin?
Yeah, one other connection I think it's important to make is that for those trans people who do want to make a transition in terms of physical transitions, they're needing to come into the medical system. And for many years, the medical system has not been terribly ready to hear that or to provide that service. And I think the lesson that was learned was from HIV activism, which was coming from a particular gay community. But people standing up and saying, I need a voice in my medical care. I need a equal voice, if not the louder voice, to the doctors and the drug companies and people who were not having the same stake as I might have had, was a strong lesson learned by trans people when they came in to say, I want to be able to get medical care for the problems that I have.
Manny Deutsch from UCSF.
You know, I just want to point out that sometimes I feel like identity politics can get into the middle of all of this. And when subpopulations, be it the larger kind of Venn diagram of both sexual orientation and gender identity minorities, or just within the trans community itself, when we start being divided and talking about this is why the needles moved, no, this is why the needles moved, the people who are oppressing us have won, because when you divide an oppressed population, the oppressors win. So, you know, I'm thinking that it's multifactorial. You know, I'm thinking back to the AIDS, the start of the AIDS epidemic. People remember who Ryan White was, right? Ryan White was a heterosexual, wholesome white boy from the middle of the country who had hemophilia. And he was the face that the HIV movement put on the movement to sell it to people. And it's unfortunate that these are sometimes the way that things go, but the groundwork and all of the fabric that's been laid by decades of work by a whole bunch of different populations, and then we've got these high visibility people. And so I think it's important that we just try to move past the identity politics. I hope that the bridges can be built between the kind of sexual minority, LGB side, and the trans side, and really just focus on the fact of what Anand said, which is people are really uncomfortable with gender expression and how people are behaving, and that's really what we're up against. That's the root of transphobia and homophobia.
So let's take it from this kind of theoretical arc of history level to something a little bit more personal. I wanted to play a clip from the Bruce Jenner interview on 2020 to start the part of the conversation that we'll just try to frame for our listeners who might have a varied experience or awareness of the transgender community, what it actually means to be transgender. So let's go ahead with that.
I look at guys and I go, he's comfortable in his own skin, you know? And I thought, wouldn't that be a nice way to go through life? I look at women all the time thinking, oh my God, how lucky are they that they can wake up in the morning and be themselves. But me, I'm stuck here in the middle, and I got nowhere to go. Which way do I go?
So the very brief clip from a longer interview with Diane Sawyer, I wanted to get your thoughts. Again, go around the room here. Why don't we start now with you, Barry Zevin. How many times have you heard this kind of descriptor of a person's narrative?
Millions of times. I've heard it from 75-year-old people. I've heard it from 14-year-old people. I've heard it from lots of people who come in and describe discomfort, describe confusion at how other people see them, describe the pain, really, of looking in the mirror and not seeing what is inside them. And that expresses itself in all kinds of ways, but ultimately it's the ultimate stress that tends to make people sick.
Yes, Maddie.
Yeah, I just want to say exactly what Barry said. I mean, it's just a narrative I hear over and over again, and I can relate to it personally just because of my own identity as a transgender woman. And I think Barry said it great.
The place that's amazing is sometimes, a lot of times as a doctor, I'm the first person somebody's ever said it to. And the healing that can come from somebody just being able to say it and to have a professional say, yes, I've heard that before. Yeah, I've heard that a million times before. And there's a million ways of being in this world. And you get to figure out how you're going to be in this world. That is a tremendous moment, both as a doctor to be able to help somebody that way and for the people that I'm talking to.
And Jameson Green, with WPATH, the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, you talked about the 70s through 90s to today being a historical moment where there was this incremental adjustment, writing, so to speak, of policies to treat transgender individuals more equitably and equally. Have we come to understand in that course of that period, what have we come to understand scientifically to help us understand this this experience that I think from that I've saw about, it's estimated about 700,000 Americans consider themselves transgender. Who knows what the real number is, right, given given issues of stigma. So what have we come to understand?
Well, I think we're coming to understand. I don't think we have full evidence yet, but I think we're coming to understand that gender identity is a definite component of sex, basically, and that it's that sex and sexual orientation and all of those components that comprise one's sense of oneself as male or female or something in between, basically is unique and different for every person, and that there's nothing wrong with that. That's normal. That's typical. It isn't really that everybody has to be in one box or the other.
So basically, transgender is not a third box. Is it trying to explode the notion of gender?
There are some cultures that like the third box. India is one. Some of the cultures in Asia. Want actually to be called third sex. I think given our legal structure and our social history in this country, that I think that a third sex, a third box, would be a bad idea.
Say more.
I think that basically would allow trans people to be carved out and then be forced again into some other box that didn't fit them. I think if we actually open up the categories and see people as who they are and who they want to be respected as, and allow them to engage in the world in the way that's most comfortable for them, that we will have a much more productive society.
Anand, you want to add something there?
In terms of what we've learned over the last, 20, 30, 40 years of research, of course, underscoring what Jameson has said, that the gender identity is a core part of a person's psychology, and that it's not an aberrant thing, and everybody has a gender identity, not just transgender people. And we've learned a lot of different things. We're now seeing transgender and gender nonconforming people being researched and studied in lots of different contexts, whether it's the medical field, where we're seeing that effectively treating gender dysphoria, which is the medical diagnosis for transgender people, helps overall health outcomes, that if someone comes in with depression and anxiety and is also identifying as a gender that doesn't match their physical expression of gender. If you treat the gender dysphoria, the depression and the anxiety gets a lot better. In some cases, in many cases, goes away altogether. We're seeing things in social science research where we're being able to dig in more now to the social and structural problems that transgender people are facing in relationships, in employment, in schools, in families, and we're learning, you know, a lot of good news about the resilience that transgender people have and creative skills that allow us to cope with the world that's not built for us. And we're also learning a lot of really harsh statistics around, you know, everything from discrimination in healthcare, where we know that 1 in 5 transgender people has been refused medical care, whether that was in an emergency situation or primary care or mental health. They've been turned away. We know that over 70% of transgender people have experienced employment discrimination, whether that was in hiring, retention, or termination. We know that many, many people in the transgender community are economically disadvantaged and, you know, kind of fitting into this pattern that I'm describing of not being able to get a job that they're quite qualified for or be able to keep it because of workplace discrimination. It pushes a lot of people into areas of the economy that are not well protected. A lot of people work in the sex industry. A lot of people work in the drug industry. And that, of course, is not a safe environment for most people. And, of course, it then puts you at risk of policing and incarceration. There are many, many more transgender people incarcerated than is representative of our population in the general population. And so then you have all these issues compounding on top of each other. But again, there's a lot of resilience and there's a lot of problems.
Maddie Deutsch.
You know, I just want to kind of talk about the concept of identity and the different range of identities. And is there a third box, or are you a woman who is transgender as well as a woman who has red hair and a woman who works as an attorney? Or are you a transgender woman and that's specifically what you are, as opposed to a woman of transgender history? And the reality is that transgender people have spent their lives being put into boxes. And when they show up in my office and they're looking for some kind of gender-affirming treatment, they're looking for hormones or they're looking for a referral for surgery or something, you know, I'm thinking about, what can I do to help this person be whoever they are? And I'm thinking less about, do they fit into a specific box, or can I categorize them as a woman or a transgender man or a man? And I'm thinking more from a cultural humility perspective, which is, I'm going to let this person tell me about who they are, and then I'm going to figure out how I can get them to that place, as long as it's, you know, medically reasonable, and as long as I'm making sure that all of the important details are taken care of, and less concerned about trying to take transgender people and then put them into another box. And the last thing I want to say is, when we do look at the societies where there's the existence of these third genders, Thailand, India, I actually want to question, you know, the quality of life of living in that third box in those countries is poor. You're a second class citizen. And so I actually have some questions about people who, you know, may identify in a third box outside. If those people were given the opportunity in a vacuum and some safe, protected room where they could say whatever they wanted and whoever they were, would they choose to go with the third? Or are they identifying in that third space because that's the space that's been carved out for them in culture and in society? So, you know, I think that sometimes we look at other societies that have these third options, but they're also second-class options. And so, again, I'm just thinking, people are whoever they are, and how can I help affirm them? And as Anand very correctly noted, when we provide gender-affirming treatments to transgender people, their lives get better. And when 1 in 3 transgender people report attempting suicide, not thinking about suicide, but actually attempting suicide, we have a high cost of failure. We have in medicine something called the number needed to treat and the number needed to harm. The number needed to treat is the number of people you need to treat with a given intervention in order to have a positive effect. And the number needed to harm is the converse. The number needed to treat in transgender people is about 1. If you treat 1 transgender person, you're going to make 1 person better. And you don't need to treat 2 people to make 1 person better. You treat 2 people, you make 2 people better.
We're going to pause for a moment so that we can ask for your support during this, our spring membership drive here at KLW. Debbie?
Thank you, Joseph. This is our spring membership campaign, and it is New Member Monday, which means that we want anyone who has never given to KLW before, you know, perhaps you've given to other public radio stations, you know, it feels really good, but it's time to pledge your support to KLW. We're halfway to our goal of 100 new members today, and we are past halfway in our financial goal, which is really, really great, but we need your support to continue on. 800-525-9917 is the number, or klw.org. And to further entice you, we have a challenge for the hour of $250 from Ruth Cohn of San Francisco, who has put up $250 and says she will match donations up to that amount if you contribute. So we need your support right now. 800-525-9917, klw.org. Now back to you, Joseph.
Thanks, Debbie. And this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web. Excuse me, at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing challenges faced by transgender community here in San Francisco and across the country and around the world with our guest, Dr. Maddie Deutsch, Director of Clinical Services at UCSF's Center of Excellence for Transgender Health, Dr. Jameson Green, President of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health, also known as WPATH, and author of Becoming a Visible Man. By phone, we're joined by Anand Kalra, Program Administrator of the Transgender Law Center, and also here in the studio, Dr. Barry Zevin, Clinical Lead with the Transgender Health Services of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have a friend or loved one who is transitioning? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you have a question about what it means to transition and to be transgender, we want to hear from you. 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at cityvisions. KALW. So, Maddie Deutsch, I wanted to stay with you. You were talking there about you know, what it means to allow someone access to the types of treatment that, in the way you describe it, are literally life-saving.
Yeah, these treatments are actually, many of them are very inexpensive. They're very straightforward, and the medical risks associated with hormone therapy are very minimal for the most part. And without getting into too much of the details, but these are treatments that are in the same frame as menopausal hormone therapy or contraception, managing men who have low testosterone levels. So the risks associated with the medications are fairly minimal. And you contrast that to the profound benefits that people feel. I mean, just time and time again, and we can speak about research until we're blue in the face, but also just talking about anecdotes of patients that I've seen, the 1,200 patients I've taken care of in the last 9 years, just time and time and time again, you see people come in their first couple of visits and they're anxious and they're uncomfortable and they're closed off, and then you just see them unfurl and kind of develop into these people who just have so much to give to society, and then they're thriving and their careers, or they're getting their lives in order, or they're just, you know, moving forward with a relationship with someone. They're able to interface with the world in some capacity, and it really is just it's moving. And at the same time, it raises the fairly significant issue that not everybody has access to all of these services. And we have insurance exclusions. That is a patchwork state by state in this country. We don't have federally mandated everybody has to be covered for everything all the time. We have multiple tiers of health insurance in this country, as we know. And so there are several different classes of care that people have access to. And so that's another problem. And it's very challenging for me sometimes to see one patient who maybe has got no insurance or who has Medi-Cal, and then I have another patient who's maybe Medicare, and then I have another patient with kind of a high-value Cadillac health plan, and they may all have different levels of access to transgender, to gender-affirming care, and there may be all these hoops that people have to jump through. And some people who may have some confounding psychosocial issues, housing issues, mental health, substance abuse, some of which may be driven by unaffirmed gender, which results in possibly behavioral health issues and substance abuse in a way to self-medicate. When you're dealing with all of these coexisting issues, it makes it even more difficult sometimes to navigate through the gender affirmation healthcare system. And so I feel like we are in need of both developing a kind of national policy approach to this, that this is just something that just needs to be covered, like cholesterol medication, or I was going to say contraception, but I'm not going to jump into that pool right now. But cholesterol medication or diabetes or other things with proven benefit. And then we need to move forward in developing infrastructure that allows these services to be delivered, which includes case management if needed to help move people through these services. And it also includes having university-based programs that can train doctors, that can train surgeons in how to do these procedures, so that if an insurance company or a health system says, okay, well, now we're going to provide coverage for this service, well, great. Well, now where do you go to get the service?
And so if you want to join our conversation, I'll give you that number. It's 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. We have a couple of phone lines open. Let's go to our first caller, Karen in Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Oh, yes. Good evening. I was just wondering what an operation or what a transition operations might cost someone who was just that wasn't a celebrity or didn't have millions of dollars or wasn't a high profile, but just someone that really needed that kind of help. And if you even knew if these people that are celebrities, if they are reaching out and donating any of their money to help other people transition, if you know anything about that.
All right, Karen, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Barry Zevin.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. So far, none of the celebrities has reached out to me to donate free operations, but here's to hoping for that. So the thing to realize is that for each person, there is a different needs, different kinds of surgeries, and a range of things that could be offered. A lot of times people think of sex reassignment surgery or gender affirmation surgery as a vaginoplasty for a transgender woman. The cost of that, depending on a number of factors, but $30,000, $35,000 if you're paying a surgeon directly in cash. And that is mostly how people have obtained that surgery in the past. Now in California, all managed care insurance and all insurance is required to pay for these surgeries. So, of course, the insurance companies negotiate with the surgeons. But that's generally the cost for that surgery. Surgeries for transgender men can range in the same range. The most complex surgery, which is called phalloplasty, can range to $50,000 or even higher, depending on a number of factors, and can be much more complicated.
Maddie.
You know, I just wanted to comment on one thing. We're not quite there in California where everybody has to pay for it all across the board. There are a bunch of different loopholes. If you have what's called a self-insured plan, those plans are not currently required to cover these surgeries. And then there are some, the way the wording is, there are other ways that insurance companies can sometimes put up barriers or just get out of paying for it completely. So again, we still have this patchwork of accessing services. And the other thing I wanted to say about accessing surgery is, and Barry started talking about this as well, is that I think historically you might see on a daytime talk show, you would see, you know, tomorrow meet so-and-so as they go for their final step in becoming a woman. And when you think about, that's not really how it is. And the WPATH standards of care currently describe much more of an individualized approach where there's a whole range of gender-affirming medical treatments, surgeries, and each transgender person may or may not access some of those procedures. And we're really trying to move away from their saying that, well, you need to do this, this, and that in order to be a woman. And if you think about that from a feminist perspective and just in the, you know, coming up with a litmus test of who is or who isn't a woman or who isn't a man. And so, you know, I think a lot of people are very interested in the specter of someone's going into somewhere looking like a lumberjack and they come out looking like a bombshell or whatever. But that's actually not really how it works. And one other thing I want to point out just about paying for surgery, there is a foundation that's called the Jim Collins Foundation, which is their mission is to provide scholarships for people to basically get their surgery paid for when they're not otherwise able to get it paid for. And it's out there, and it's, you know, they are only able to provide a couple of awards each year, but I just want people to know that it exists. It's unfortunate that we're having to you know, turn to foundations to support medical treatment that's been proven to be effective. And if I can just make one more comment, if a transgender person attempts suicide because their gender is unaffirmed, they take a bunch of Tylenol, they wind up in the ICU for a week, that ICU stay is more expensive than vaginoplasty. So there's a cost-benefit analysis to be done here, too, in addition to just doing the right thing.
Hmm. Jameson Green, we heard WPATH mentioned there. What do you want to add to this piece?
Well, actually, first I want to add that the Jim Collins Foundation was started by a couple of trans men who are friends of mine, and that it's a grassroots operation. It's not just so that, you know, people hear the word foundation and they think Ford Foundation. No, this is really, really grassroots, seat of the pants sort of stuff, and they're collecting from anyone who will donate to that to us, and it's tricky. And they also talk the surgeons into donating their services as well. You know, so they're working really hard to fill this gap that exists because of our patchwork of insurance coverage and, you know, care availability. WPATH really has evolved considerably in its 36 years of existence. And from the first standards of care that were issued in 1979 we're now at the seventh version of the standards that were issued in 2011. And these standards actually affirm the fact, as Maddie said, that people are individuals, and trans people are individuals too, and we're not cookie cutter people, and we're not trying to be cookie cutter people, which is what often people think, that we bear the burden of gender stereotyping because we're trying to live up to gender stereotypes as if no one else ever does. And we are not necessarily trying to live up to gender stereotypes. Probably some people are. A lot of people aren't. But, you know, people are different. People come from all walks of life, from all levels of education, from all races and classes, and they all need different individualized care.
Anand, I wanted to hear from you on this issue of access. What are you and your colleagues at the Transgender Law Center working on, or what do you see as the hurdles in front of the movement to broaden the access to this type of care?
That's a great question. Access to care is, of course, as everyone on the panel has been saying, is so critical to people being able to live happy, healthy lives. What the current state of affairs is that nine states and the District of Columbia have non-discrimination regulations or guidance from their divisions of insurance, which are the state agencies that regulate all the plans, health insurance plans that are sold in the state. And in nine states in the District of Columbia, this guidance has come out and says that treating transgender people differently than you treat non-transgender people in the course of benefits administration constitutes discrimination. So, for example, if you cover hormone therapy for a menopausal woman and then you don't cover the exact same treatment for a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, that constitutes discrimination. And so that makes a huge, huge difference. It takes you from a situation where just 4 years ago, less than 4 years ago even, this was the case in no states. And now we've got nine states plus D.C., so almost 20% of the states, and I think population-wise it's a little bit more than that, you know, if you have employer-sponsored insurance, as long as your employer doesn't have what Maddie was describing as a self-funded plan, which is a little too technical for now, but we have some resources on our website that can explain that stuff for you. You're no longer at the behest of kind of the popular opinion on whether your medical care is necessary. So we've worked closely with advocates in each state where this has happened. It doesn't happen by accident. It takes a lot of work. One, you have to get the attention of people who make these decisions and let them know, hey, we're here and we're real and our issues are real and we're not going away. And then be able to go from there to getting good policies on the books, and then once good policies are on the books, then you've got to do all that administrative work of building in the systems that can account for transgender people. If you think about the medical system, and if you just think about electronic health records for a second, and Maddie's kind of the expert on the panel about this, so I won't go too much into this, but if you just think about the last time you went to see your healthcare provider, or if you were in the hospital, every time someone called your name or checked your records, they checked this M or F box and made sure that you were you. And for transgender people, that doesn't work very well because what we have anatomically may not match 100% with what is assumed to be the case. So you've got to build all these systems in place so that we can account for transgender people, so that when a transgender man, for example, has a pelvic exam, the insurance company doesn't come back and say, oh, we don't, you have an M on your file and we don't cover pap smears for men. You know, that doesn't make sense to us. You know, so that people are having to go through these arguments with their insurance companies every time they get any kind of routine procedure or routine checkup. So where we are in these nine states and D.C. is at the level of implementation and kind of building these systems into place. And that's just for private insurance. Now, this guidance applies to what we call managed care Medicaid plans, which is again a little technical for right now. In some cases, it applies to Medicaid plans, but most often you need an explicit rule from the Medicaid governing agency in the state to clarify that similar kinds of non-discrimination provisions exist.
So I wanted to give us another chance to ask for your support at this time. If you like hearing this kind of radio, where you might not hear it in a lot of other places, this is your chance to show your support, especially if you're not a member yet. New member Monday. Debbie Kennedy, tell us about it.
Thanks, Joseph. Yes, it's New Member Monday. Our goal is for 100 new members to join KALW. And absolutely, we are halfway there, and we can use your support to bring us closer to our goal. We're also halfway through our financial goal, and we are also in a challenge. So Ruth Cohn of San Francisco has put up $250 to challenge other listeners to call for support. And that number is 800-525-9917. Or KALW.org is where you can make an e-pledge. And a very, very, very generous donor in San Francisco who wishes to remain anonymous has pledged support because this person loves City Visions. 800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thanks.
Yes, and this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing challenges faced by the transgender community with our guest, Dr. Maddie Deutsch, Director of Clinical Services at UCSF's Center of Excellence for Transgender Health, Dr. Jameson Green, President of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health and author of Becoming a Visible Man, Dr. Barry Zevin, Clinical Lead at the Transgender Health Services at the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and by phone, Anand Kalra, Program Administrator at Transgender Law Center. We have open phone lines for you if you'd like to join our conversation in the last few minutes of our program. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial. We also have electronic ways to join us. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a tweet at cityvisionsKALW. So let's go to Sharon in Mountain View. Sharon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Go ahead. I just love your program. I caught it by accident on my drive home. My son is trans. He's female to male. He's transitioned. And I wanted to mention there are resources for families who, if they discover their child is trans or their child comes out to them as trans, there are resources. The one that was tremendously helpful to me is a Yahoo group, Parents of Transsexuals, I think it is, but you can find it out on Yahoo, and it's a wonderful group of people around the world supporting each other as they learn more about what it means to be transgender and to have a member of the family be transgender, and a great source of resources and advice and just listening support via email.
If you don't mind, if I can keep you on the line for a second, I just wanted to ask you a follow-up question. What was one of the biggest challenges you had in this process within your family, and what is one of the surprises you came away with?
I would say the biggest challenge was for, honestly, my husband to really understand and accept it. We ended up going to counseling. He wasn't interested in getting on the mailing group. He did make a few phone calls to people. It was a tremendous challenge for him to adjust his mental model. And for me, I think it really helped the first week when my son came out to us. He was in college. And I thought, who can I talk to who can tell me, is this just a fad at college or is this just the real thing? And I called a college psychologist who was just tremendously helpful to me over the phone. And then I thought about it in my own head, and the quote from Shakespeare, you know, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. And I thought, you know, it's the person inside is the same person. It's they're just becoming more fully themselves. So it doesn't matter what the name, if it's male or female, it's that person is still there. And so I think, you know, that really, that's what did it for me and this group. And then my, you know, it was just a transition for my husband, and that was a big deal.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing such a personal story with us on the air.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. It's wonderful. My son's doing great. And anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Maddie Deutsch.
You know, I want to first commend the caller for sharing her story and also for the support she's shown her son. And we know time and time again from study after study and just personal experience after personal experience that when transgender children receive support from their family, it's one of the most important predictors of them having a good outcome and a successful life. And you know, the focus on transgender youth is really where things are moving in the future as people begin to identify themselves as transgender younger and younger. And all of the questions of how do we decide when is the right time to start going to school, presenting as a different gender, when puberty comes around, you know, is it the right time to delay puberty with puberty-blocking medicines? Is it the right time to begin actually taking hormones and only go through your desired puberty as opposed to the puberty associated with your birth sex? So these are all areas that we're going to be seeing a lot more of, we're going to be hearing a lot more about. But again, I think the most important thing is that we know that once people get to puberty and after puberty, the regret rate saying I've transitioned and it was a mistake is about 1%. And so when people get to that point, the best thing that you can do is support them, and they're going to go on and have a successful life. And there's really, you know, there's no other way to do it.
I want to, in the last five or so minutes of the program, I want to ask Dr. Barry Zevin a little bit about what it's like to work in the public health realm in this area. Well, you mentioned you work with a lot of people who are living with poverty. Tell us about how that experience is yet another layer here to be contended with.
Well, I think it's an important layer to, first of all, think about how come so many trans people end up living in poverty, and this is the result of often lifetimes of discrimination, often a lot of trauma in people's lives. And when we meet people, sometimes they feel like they're on their last hope. And we try to be open to what people need, meet people where they're at, recognize the level of trauma that people have, and what's been great, and I've worked in public health for over 20 years. I've done healthcare for the homeless work for over 20 years. Most of my patients have many, many problems. Being able to work with transgender people, even people in some of the worst circumstances imaginable, and being able to show the level of acceptance that we can when people come in, we see amazing changes. We're able to see people who are able to make changes in their life, sometimes a little better than some of the other people with other kinds of problems that come into my practice, whose life problems are equally as severe, but don't have a way to focus on, hey, this is a way to you want to make a change that will make you healthier, and we can be working on that by working on work with substance use, cigarette smoking, alcohol use, mental health help, and help for chronic medical problems. The motivation there is incredible when people feel accepted and feel like, hey, I'm actually finally in my life moving to a place where I'm not facing constant discrimination, and I'm moving in my life toward a place where I actually feel more comfortable with my gender identity. People make tremendous changes. That said, I spend a lot of time trying to help people with homelessness, people with a lot of isolation, people who have been rejected by their families, and trying to create community, I think, is in many ways the most important thing that we can do for folks who have lost a lot of sense of community.
And Anand Kalra, I wanted to focus on in a couple of moments here that we have left around the work around employment discrimination. What's on the forefront there?
Well, there was a huge victory back in 2012, just a couple years ago, in which the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, the EEOC, ruled that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which has to do with sex discrimination, applies to transgender people, to gender identity and gender expression, which is absolutely enormous because anyone in any state who is employed, if they experience discrimination, they can file a complaint with the EEOC and under sex discrimination, and that means that they effectively are protected. Now, of course, the law is a remedial kind of a tool, meaning it only fixes things after they happen, right? It can't you can't prevent your boss from doing something, but it creates an incentive for employers to comply with non-discrimination laws and to comply with Title VII. There are now 13 states and D.C. that have statewide or district-wide laws that prohibit discrimination in employment. Some additional ones have non-discrimination laws that apply to public accommodations, which is things like restaurants, hotels, stores, hospitals, public facilities, things like that. So the more legal ground that we're able to make, the better it is for each individual trans person, and both at the level of, if I experience discrimination, I have recourse, but also it gives people a sense of protection and a sense of security. Job stress is a huge player in people's daily lives. And if we can eliminate at least some of the stress around, am I going to be fired for being who I am at my job, then that goes a long way towards helping people have, overall healthy lives.
Jameson Green, you're going to get the last word here. What do you see in the future, in the next years ahead, as kind of where the movement for transgender rights is heading next?
I think transgender people are going to see more and more acceptance. I think we have battles ahead, but I think that we will overcome them. I think that that ignorance and education and ignorance will be overcome by education, and that access to health care will indicate that trans people are human beings. And this is all coming together much faster than I actually expected it would 30 years ago.
And we'll have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dr. Maddie Deutsch, Director of Clinical Services at UCSF's Center for Excellence for Transgender Health, Dr. Jameson Green, President of the World Professional Association of Transgender Health and author of Becoming a Visible Man, Dr. Barry Zevin, Clinical Lead at the Transgender Health Services of the San Francisco Department of Public Health, and by phone, Anand Kalra, Program Administrator of the Transgender Law Center. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. We'll be off for Memorial Day next Monday. My co-host David Onick will be back in 2 weeks as we cover the Bay Area's Fight for 15 labor movement. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.